This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For anyone who's ever written a school essay, played a game of Scrabble, or needed a heavy book to dry flowers, it's hard to imagine a world without dictionaries. But the English language existed and evolved for centuries without a reference book to guide its users. Chaucer, Bacon, even William Shakespeare crafted their works without the aid of conclusive definitions and common word usage. It wasn't until the middle of the 18th century that Samuel Johnson published his seminal work, A Dictionary of the English Language, and as wonderful as it was, for many of Britain's amateur philologists and wannabe lexicographers, it wasn't good enough. In his new book, The Meaning of Everything, Simon Winchester traces the long gestation of the project that would produce the final word on the English language, the Oxford English Dictionary. Simon Winchester is our guest this hour to talk about the mighty OED, the many personalities and characters behind it, the colossal task that they faced, and the living, changing language that they sought to capture. Later this hour, we'll be joined by Jack Lynch, a Samuel Johnson scholar who's just republished excerpts from the Johnson Dictionary, and we want to hear from you. Tell us if you have an OED, and if so, how you use it. What about other dictionaries? Do you relish or revile the inconsistencies and foreign influences of English? And if it's not your mother tongue, what stumps you about the English language? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And an email challenge. You can send us your favorite English language definition. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Simon Winchester. His latest book is The Meaning of Everything, the Story of the Oxford English Dictionary. And Simon, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Nice to hear from you.
Before we talk about the creation of the OED and the many personalities who worked on it, I wanted you to set the scene for this project. It's the middle of the 19th century in Britain, a Victorian period, a time of high ambition and incredibly high education, at least for some.
I was astonished by the knowledge that people had, the elite, it has to be said, but the educated elite of England in the 19th century, they were educated beyond the ability of any of us these days to imagine. They seemed to know everything about everything. They had this astonishing sense of self-confidence. I was reading a piece from the Times, actually from 1928, when the OED was completed, referring totally matter-of-factly about a rebellion of the Zaranac tribe making their way to Sana'a, talking about tribes and geographical features that one normally would never hear of. But there's no explanation in the Times as to where this might be or how important or unimportant these people are, because it was assumed that any reader of the Times would simply know that this was a little rebellion happening in, as it happens, Yemen. The people that worked on the OED were astonishingly knowledgeable, and we may deride them at this remove for being, you know, blimpish and bombastic and pompous and imperialist, but they knew their stuff, and that's one of the reasons that I admire them so much.
Yeah, there's one who I forget his name, but he said, well, the first 12 languages are the hardest to learn. After that, the next 100, pretty easy.
Yes, he was the same chap who could read terribly easily upside down, because he always looked at the Bible on his father's knee when he was kneeling in front of his father for evening prayer, and learned how to read everything upside down. So not only could he read dozens of languages, but he could read upside down and probably back to front as well.
Now, remind us, what existed in the mid-19th century by way of dictionaries, and why was that deemed so insufficient that this gigantic effort was required?
Well, you mentioned Samuel Johnson as being the first, and just, this is no correction, but just to be pedantic, because after all, everything about dictionaries is based on pedantry. It's a lightning rod for pedants, as my inbox amply displays. The first ever dictionary was edited in 1604 by a man called Robert Cawdrey, and this set off a firestorm of interest in lexicography, and by the middle of the 17th century, 1660 or 1670, there were dozens of dictionaries available. Samuel Johnson, about whom Jack knows far more than I can ever imagine knowing, and we'll talk about it later, created the first proper dictionary, a big two-volume monster in the mid-1750s, 1760s. And for 100 years, that was the dictionary. If anyone said, I'm going to look it up in the dictionary, that was the one they went to, Samuel Johnson. But if to set the scene, if you can imagine the 5th of November, 1857, so 100 years later, a meeting of the Philological Society of London, all men, all with beards, all white, I dare say. My girlfriend always derides me for only writing about dead white men with beards.
Beards, yes.
Gathered in a building that still exists at the northwest corner of St. James's Square in London, the now called the London Library, a private lending library. It rented out rooms to the Philological Society, and they met there to listen to a speech by a man called Richard Chenevicks Trench, who was the Dean of Westminster, later to become Archbishop of Dublin. He was giving a two-part paper, which he entitled On Some Deficiencies in Our English Dictionaries.
Modest title, yes.
A very modest title. I beg, gentlemen, to put to you that Samuel Johnson, marvellous a dictionary though it has been for the last 100 years, is in fact wanting. And it's wanting in several ways. Its definitions, for instance, are eccentric, to say the very least, and the most infamous, I'm sure many listeners will know it, is the definition that Johnson wrote of the word oats, O-A-T-S, in which he said a grain commonly given to horses, but which in Scotland feeds the people. I mean, it's a lovely definition, but it ain't right. I mean, it's not what any schoolchild should really be taught. So the definitions were eccentric. He had a habit of making up quotations to justify the things he was including in the book. And this in a way was the most severe criticism that Chenevicks Trench levelled at the book, it only included about 40,000-45,000 words. And while no one really knew how big the English language was in its entirety, there was a sneaky feeling that this language, which sort of was in the air, rather like the oxygen we breathe, was somehow bigger than 45,000 words. No one had any idea how big it was, but, said Chenevicks Trench to these philologists, let us, with all this sort of arrogant self-confidence that we Victorians have in our bones at the moment, let us make a supreme effort to gather together every word in the language, no matter how long it'll take us, write the definitions and prepare a dictionary which has none of the deficiencies of Johnson. It may, he said, take us 10 years. It may occupy 4 volumes. He was so underestimating the task that lay ahead, but that was basically the task he set. And so these old gentlemen filed out into the fog that night, muttering, my God, he's got a rather good idea, this bishop fellow. And so they set themselves to the task, and 70 years later, they finished it, or they sort of finished it, because, of course, it continues to this day.
And it is, in many ways, at least you write, the nature of the language itself, a conglomeration of invader after invader making contributions over many, many centuries and thousands of years. You write, English is not to be regarded in the same way as, say, French or Italian, in one crucially important way. It is not a fixed language, the meaning of its words established, approved, and firmly set by some official committee charged with preserving its dignity and integrity.
Well, we, in a very chauvinistic way, to use a French-inspired word, are very proud of this fact that our language is the language of invaders. I mean, we were these foggy, damp islands off the northwest coast of Europe, invaded by a succession of people, Celts from the Danube, Romans from Rome, then the Huns, the Saxons, the Frisians, the you know, people from all of Northern Europe, then the French in 1066, that infamous year. But each one of them, bringing whatever, their brutality, their food, their dress or whatever, also brought with them the language. And so our language that we speak, both here and in England, of course, the English language, is a bit like America in a way. America's drawn its people, a pluribus unum, from all over the world. We have drawn our language from all over the world in a way that France and Germany and Italy have not. Their language is self, it's grown from within. It's an intrinsic, it grew on the Loire and the Rhone and the Rhine and the Po Valley and wherever. It didn't come from all over. Those countries, specifically France and Italy, have and have had for the last 300 or 400 years official committees of grave men who oversee the purity of the language, and in the case of the French, absolutely disdain the introduction of words like le weekend and le sandwich and le nightclub, because it infects the purity of the language. We say, to heck with that, infect all you like. It just enriches the language and makes it more usable, which is why French, spoken in Francophone Africa and the Pacific Islands and France, but very little else elsewhere, English, spoken everywhere. When Monsieur Chirac and Chancellor, whatever his name is, what's the Chancellor of Germany? I forget his name. This is a terrible thing to say. Schroeder, were meeting the other day, they spoke in English. They didn't want to admit it to anyone, but it's everyone's second language and an awful lot of people's first language, not least because it's such a slippery, fluid, all-embracing mongrel tongue.
We've got some responses to our email challenge. Betty Bishop in Chester, California. Limacious, slug-like is one that she likes. And R. Lommel, a pretty good name, in Bloomington, Indiana, writes, I think my all-time favorite English definition has to be coprophagus. I hope I'm getting
that. Oh, please. That's revolting.
A wonderfully fancy-sounding word that means, somewhat politely, dung-eating.
Yes.
I first heard the word in discussion on an unscrupulous lawyer, but with the meaning concealed in such a word, I think many listeners probably thought the word a compliment. Let's get a caller in. Mary Alice joins us on the line from Charleston, South Carolina. Mary Alice, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Yes. First, I want to thank him for writing such wonderful books.
Oh, wait, you're going to get
so
a big
kind.
Argument there.
Yes.
And one of the first books I bought with my own money was an Oxford English Dictionary. It was about 20 pounds, full with all sorts of good stuff.
Which edition was it?
You know, I don't know. It would have been about 1962.
So it was a whole bunch of volumes then.
No, it was probably a condensed one because it was one very large 20-pounder.
I see. And did it come with a magnifying glass, or Simon, was that later?
No, that would have been earlier, I think. The ones I've seen with no, but it was wonderful because I grew up in very tiny towns with two-room schools and not enough books, and I could always find something interesting to read in that book.
I think it was probably the shorter. The shorter Oxford English Dictionary.
It was. I mean, it was only $20, which was 6 months' allowance.
But $20 for 20 pounds is pretty good.
Always pretty good. I still have my parody Burberry's. Mary Alice, thanks very much for the call. And how often do you use it?
Right now, not that often. I can't see small stuff anymore.
Well, maybe it's time to invest in one of those magnifying glasses.
In the 40-pound version, right?
It was a wonderful book. It helped me prepare for the state spelling bee. I mean, it's just wonderful.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, and happy reading.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Walter, who's with us from Blacksburg, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You've been talking about the OED kind of standardizing definitions of words for the first real time, but I'd also heard that it had a big role in standardizing spellings, that up till that time, with many words, several different spellings were in common use, and that even in some circles, being able to spell a word several different ways was a sign of education.
Huh.
I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Simon?
Well, yes, although when we talk about standardizing, please, everyone, remember that the OED seeks to be a descriptive book, not prescriptive. It doesn't lay down any rules. It simply says this is what the people do, and this is how they define words, this is how they use words. It doesn't order you to use them in a certain way. And the same goes for spelling. It presents all the alternative forms of spelling, which for some complicated words can run into several lines of type. All sorts of interesting things to say about this. For instance, I mean, going back a very long time.
A very short interesting thing
was, for instance, how you spell the plural of eggs. Caxton laid down the rule. The plural of egg in the 14th century was iron, E-Y-R-E-N. And he said, no, I prefer E-G-G-E-S. So the reason when we buy a dozen eggs today, we don't say a dozen iron, is because Caxton spelt it E-G-G-S. So others lay down the rule. Oxford merely reports what others have mentioned beforehand.
Out of the break, we'll hear some more interesting characters involved in this daunting task. One of them, Henry Sweet, notoriously rude but instrumental in the survival of the project and the model for George Bernard Shaw's Henry Higgins.
Summer lightning, and the Hebrews learn it backwards, which is absolutely frightening. But use proper English, you're regarded as a freak. Oh, why can't the English? Why can't the English learn to speak?
It's NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Simon Winchester, the author of The Meaning of Everything, the story of the Oxford English Dictionary. If you're a dictionary buff or fascinated by the English language, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Emailers, we're looking for your favorite definitions, TOTN at NPR.org. And here's one from Al Frank in Philomath, Oregon. Here's a word I discovered 2 days ago whilst browsing in the new Oxford American Dictionary, boubouasie. Noun, stupid people as a class. Origin 1920s from boob, humorous formation on the pattern of bourgeoisie. Given the many opportunities for its use, this word is sure to become a favorite. And Simon Winchester, that smacks a boubouasie of Mencken, doesn't it?
It's very Mencken-esque, I must say. May I share with you one of my favorites, though? Is this permitted?
Surely.
I don't have to send it by email, I hope. I was once asking one of the philologists at Oxford whether there's any wit in the OED, because you think of it as a rather stern 20 volumes. And he said, in a very Oxford way, wit, only inadvertently, he said. Look, for instance, at the second sense of the very rare noun abbreviator. And so I looked up abbreviator. An officer of the court of Rome appointed to draw up the Pope's briefs.
And that's pulling strings now, isn't it?
Well done, Neil. But the reason why it was inadvertent is that James Murray wrote that definition in 1898 when the word briefs means, as of course it does in many circles still today, legal document, drawing up a legal document. But it wasn't until 1933 that the word briefs came to mean underwear. So it was inadvertent humour. And it's only taken by us dirty-minded readers today to put in the double entendre, which was completely unintended.
Here's another emailer, Seth Truby in Oberlin, Ohio. Sesquipedalian, given to using long words. Okay. You were also, Simon, wrote a fascinating, speaking of individual definitions, the word radium. This was, obviously, the Curies were busy at their tasks while the dictionary was in the process of being completed.
I love this particular one. 1897, the Curies discovered radium and so named it because it emitted rays. And they wrote their discovery in two magazines, Nature and Science. And that was enough, one would have thought, for the people that were scanning the literature once they read these little sentences with the word radium in it. That was enough to put it in a dictionary. James Murray, though, was working, as it happens, on the RA section at that very time. And editors came to him with this, and he said, oh, I don't know, you know, in the very Scottish sort of caution, saying, I'm not sure that it's going to last, you know, it may not be there for very much, had half-life or something. So I think we'll leave it out for now. It may not. And so it doesn't appear in the first edition. It appears in the supplement in 1933, and of course it's been in ever since. But one of the editors was so enraged by Murray's caution that he decided he'd write his own definition. And so there's a very long etymology, all extraordinarily complex and learned. But basically he then starts quoting people, makes these quotations up. Aristotle, for instance, and he gives a reference, says radium may be obtained from the excrement of a squint-eyed rat that has died of a broken heart, buried 50 feet below the highest depths of the Western Ocean in a well-stopped tobacco tin. But Sir Thomas Browne says that this is a vulgar error. He also refutes the story that it was dug in the air above Mount Olympus by the ancients. And then he goes on to add other quotes from Pepys' diary of the 31st of June. Note it's a joke. And so to bed, found radium an excellent pick-me-up in the morning. From Hakluyt's Voyages of 1600, the king was attired simply in a hat of silk and a radium umbrella. What learning these men had. It's wonderful, I think.
Well, let's get another caller in. Brian is on the line with us from Sioux City in Iowa.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
What I'd like to know is how one proposes a new word for the common usage, and I have a candidate for such a word.
Okay, Simon, how does a word get into the OED?
It's essentially got to appear about 5 times in written literature. I mean, I tried, without meaning to steal this gentleman's thunder, I invented a word once in a column in a newspaper in London about 20 years ago, and the word was drimmens, D-R-I-M-M-E-N-S, which I defined as the grey, wet substance you leave on a kitchen floor when you walk in out of the snow in your boots. They left a trail of drimmins behind it. Seemed to work. It was drip and midden and all these words. Nobody ever used it again. So I was the only time it was ever used was this once in this column, which apparently nobody read either. And so that word would not make it into the OED or indeed in any dictionary. But perhaps if this gentleman can get this word, and he'll probably tell us in a minute what it is, and then lots of people will write it in the local newspaper, and then John Simpson, who's the editor of the OED in Oxford, or Jesse Scheidlauer, who is the American editor based here in New York, will see it, and it'll go into the third edition. So may I ask, without begging your intercession, Neil, what the word is?
Yeah, my candidate is, it has to do with the, you mentioned your girlfriend a while ago, and many of us in today's society have companions that we live with without the benefit of matrimony.
Right.
And we don't have a good handy term for that that describes the condition. And my candidate then for the word is convivant, which is with.
Beautiful.
To live with.
That's lovely, a convivant, like bon vivant, but with a C.
Right.
So a convict that you live with.
but it has connotations of conviviality and so forth.
I love it. Get it used 5 times and get Jesse Scheidlauer to pick it up, and bingo, your 15 minutes of fame is guaranteed.
There you go.
Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Getting back to that Simon Winchester, in other words, he can't just send it to the editor. That doesn't do any good.
No.
It's got to be used in the language. But that implies, and this goes back to the creation of the dictionary in the first place, you've got to read everything anybody writes ever.
And that is why, when going back to that meeting, or the two meetings in the London Library in 1857, Chenevix Trench, when he said, "This is what we want to plan," how do we do it, was the second part of his speechifying. We do it, first of all, by reading everything that has ever been written. And to accomplish this, we need a vast army of volunteers. The key to the making of the OED was this. The editors were wonderful and very, very talented men, and in later days, women as well. But the key were the readers, the volunteer, the unsung readers, thousands of them, all over the British Isles, first of all. In America, there were huge numbers. Every state of the Union supplied readers. They tended to be scholarly people with a lot of time on their hands who read a great deal. And the editors in Oxford said, "All right, America, you read, for instance, the 18th century," which there was a huge literary burgeoning in the 18th century, because this was, after all, the beginning of the country. And then other specialist reading do later. And the Americans responded with enormous enthusiasm, as did the people in India, in Australia, New Zealand, as they are still doing today. Jesse Scheidlauer, who I mentioned earlier, heads a vast army of people who are reading in America. Sooner or later, if that gentleman who called about convivant, if he does get it somehow into newspapers, and a columnist picks it up in Sioux City and another one in California and someone else in Nevada, and then it's in a book quoted, Jesse and his volunteers, sooner or later, we'll pick it up, and that's how stuff gets into the dictionary.
You wrote a book about perhaps the most curious of these volunteer readers, that William Chester Minor, the professor and the madman, which I understand is being made into a movie.
Yes, it is. In fact, I was sent the completed script the other day. It takes one or two liberties with matters romantic and sexual, but nonetheless, I'm not going to complain too much, because generally speaking, it's jolly good, and we think... the Australian who's just made that film about the crucifixion.
Mr. Gibson?
Mel Gibson. Mr. Gibson gets out from under this pile of trouble that he's in at the moment, he intends to be in it, as does Mr. Hoffman D. and all sorts of good people. They're allowing me to be in it for 15 seconds. I get shot at the beginning and then I'm the murder victim.
You're the murderee.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to speak. I'm allowed to grunt, apparently, but unless I sign up and pay my dues to equity, I'm not allowed to say anything like, "I say, that was not fair." So I slump to the ground and die, but at least I'm in the film.
Well, in any case, there are other fascinating contributors. Another American, Fitzedward Hall, a self-appointed hermit who moved to England and lived and never apparently left his shack after alienating all of his colleagues and eventually his family.
Yes.
But there were two curious English sisters who contributed, at least in terms of volume, it seems, as much as anybody.
They were amazing, the Thompson sisters. We know relatively little of them. One of them wrote a bodice ripper, one of these rather I think the term bodice ripper is known in America. Anyway, a rather sort of sensational novel involving large-breasted women and handsome men. And the other wrote a book relating to geography, which was very well received in schools. But otherwise, they lived a shy and retiring life in Liverpool and then Reigate and then somewhere else, Bath, I think it was. And from there, they contributed an enormous amount, every single one of the volumes of the OED, which was first published in fascicles to sort of part works, 350, and then later rather shorter works to keep the cash coming in as they published every year or so. There's their name, the Mrs. Thompson. The Thompson, they weren't twins, they were sisters, unmarried. Mm-hmm. And so they, unsung people, their name just seen in 8-point type, and that's all, they weren't paid, they just worked and worked and worked, as did thousands of others. Hereward Thimbleby Price. I love this man. I mean, what a name. And he was a sort of hero, captured, if I've got the right man, captured by the Germans, escaped, went to Russia, found his way to China, learned all sorts of languages on the way. He returned, went to become professor of English at the University of Michigan, having been born in Sri Lanka, no, in Madagascar, died in 1964. All sorts of strange, eccentric people contributed to this book.
Including J.R.R. Tolkien.
I should have mentioned him. J.R.R. Tolkien, much better known, of course, for contributing the word hobbit to the dictionary and to the language, and, of course, writing The Lord of the Rings. He worked in 1919, I think it was, as an assistant editor, and his task was, because they were then, in 1919, getting towards the end of the project, he was given the task of defining words beginning with W-A, waggle, wampum, and most problematical of all for him, the word walrus, which you'd think is a fairly simple word to define. I found a book of his impeccable copperplate script in the Bodleian Library of him agonising over exactly how to define walrus. In the end, if I can find walrus while I'm talking, he defined it elegantly. Page 206, sorry about this, everybody. Having said that, I can't know that.
A little incidental music while we wait for
someone. No, the seahorse or morse. I didn't know walrus was also called a morse. Trichicus rosmarus, a carnivorous pinniped marine mammal allied to the Phocidae and the Otariidae, and chiefly distinguished by two tusks, exserted upper canine teeth, inhabiting the Arctic seas. A variety found in the North Pacific has sometimes received the distinct specific name of walrus obesus. So that's what he wrote, and I'm delighted to find that J.R.R. Tolkien was involved in such a practical way in the letter W.
We have an email from Jim Tennant. I love to read. He writes, Robert Heinlein in his novel The Moon is a Harsh Mistress introduced me to the delicious word flocky nausing nihili pillification, if I've got that right.
Brilliant, Neil.
I finally found it in the Oxford Unabridged. It's a synonym for denigration. And then he sent us along a little note from a place called Word Wide Words. The word's main function is to be trotted out as an example of a long word. It's the longest in the first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, was supplanted by an even longer word, which I'm not going to try to pronounce, in the second. A rare public airing in 1999 when Senator Jesse Helms used it in commenting on the demise of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I note your distress at my flocky, nausea, nihili pillification of the CTBT. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our guest is Simon Winchester, whose new book is The Meaning of Everything, the Story of the Oxford English Dictionary. And let's get another caller in. Phil is on the line from Maplewood, Minnesota.
Hello, and thank you for the discussion on my favorite publication. I was in a bookstore a couple of years ago, and I picked up a new copy of the OED. And frankly, I was disturbed to discover the inclusion of every foul word I've ever heard, and some I haven't heard, even the multisyllabic ones. And I know the book is intended to be a reflection of the living language as we use it, but these words have been around for as long as dictionaries have been, and we've never saw fit to include them. And I wonder why now and how long they've been in there.
Well, I believe Samuel Johnson included many of them, and when a lady berated him, I'm not sure whether the gentleman is berating Oxford for including them or not, but this lady certainly berated Samuel Johnson for including the words. And he said, well, madam, I note that you've been looking for them, which suggests she had a sort of somewhat prurient interest in going through the dictionary looking for these words. It is English as she is spoke. I'm afraid all words, the N word is in there, as well as all the curse words. And Jesse Scheidler, who I've mentioned a number of times, has actually written a short monograph a couple of years ago called The F Word. So we shouldn't shy away from the fact that these words exist, and the dictionary is there to provide a catalogue, not to offer any judgment as to whether these words should or should not be used, but simply to say, this is, like it or not, warts and all, whatever cliché you want to use, this is the language in full.
And aren't there any number of words that were once regarded as vulgarities which have since been accepted as, more normally into the language?
Well, yes. I mean, I think everyone would now accept the word, that I'm not being offensive by using the word bloody. I mean, bloody is, even when I was a youngster, it was a highly offensive word. Now it's accepted as common currency, really. Bastard, similarly. I mean, you would not have used that when I was 5 or 6 years old. I would be soundly spanked for using it. But nowadays, it has become. I sense you were probably thinking of something else when you asked the question, though, Neil, were you?
Those two will do fine. Phil, but if you came across one of these words and did not know what it meant, wouldn't you be eager to have some place where you could go look it up?
Well, I would prefer to find it elsewhere than in a book that we're handing school children as a guide to how our language ought to be used. It would seem like we're proselytizing in a way by including them. And I prefer them not to be in there or in a separate book of colloquial and slang language.
Well, may I just answer the point? It is the OED, I must stress, is not a suggestion on how the language might be used or ought to be or should be used. It's simply an illustration of what there is in the language. It's like a gigantic file cabinet full of biographies of every single word that exists. It doesn't suggest you do or don't use them. It simply says, here they are. Do with them what you will.
Phil, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we have a couple of other offers of definitions from our emailers. And if you'd like to join them, our email address is totn@npr.org. Bruce Kanagaki in San Antonio suggests kakistocracy, a government by the worst or least qualified. And M. Walker, I love the meaning of the word sincere as without wax. This refers to a time when Roman potters who used only clay in their work etched sincere, presumably, on the bottom of the pots to indicate that this was the genuine article, not cut with impurities. So one of the many etymologies of the word sincere. Our guest is Simon Winchester. His latest book is The Meaning of Everything, The Story of the Oxford English Dictionary. When we come back from a short break, the book that was written 173 years before the OED was published, Samuel Donson's Dictionary of the English Language. Simon Winchester will stay with us as we discuss that, well, not first dictionary, but that first true dictionary, at least in his definition, and you can email him with all of your corrections. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Simon Winchester. We've been discussing the story of the Oxford English Dictionary, the subject of his latest book, The Meaning of Everything. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. If you have a favorite definition, why don't you email it to us? We've been reading several suggestions from listeners, and one of them was about what used to be the longest word word in the English language. And on the line with us now from Franklin, Michigan, is Brian. And I did not attempt to read what is now the longest word in the English language, or at least the longest word in the Oxford English Dictionary. Brian, I understand you're willing to give it a shot.
Sure. Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
Pneumo ultra microscopica silica volcano coniosis.
And how long have you been practicing that?
Actually, I learned that word in the seventh grade.
Really?
Yes.
And why?
Well, we were studying black lung, and I believe it's associated to that in some way, shape, or form. I don't know if Mr. Winchester would be able to address that or not.
Simon?
Well, it certainly is, and I had my first newspaper training in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, surrounded by coal mines, and people were all the time being admitted into hospital with pneumoconiosis and silicosis. But this particular ailment that you're talking about comes from people that ingest spores of, or particles of dust from volcanoes.
Oh,
so it's the people that live in Indonesia or in Chile or in Alaska that have the same respiratory problems that you might suffer if you worked on a coal mine. But in their case, it's from living too close to an active volcano.
Not a problem in Michigan, I suspect.
No, not a problem in Flint, Michigan.
Okay.
Now, one more question I had, if I could. The actual letter count of that word, is that available?
Not to my small brain, I'm afraid. No,
At one point in time, I knew how to spell the whole thing, and I believe it was 44 letters.
I actually have it written down somewhere, but I can't find it in my pile of paper, and...
Well, if you could address that before the end of the show, that'd be great.
I'll try to address it before the end of the show. Thanks very much for the phone call.
I appreciate it, Neil.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Joining us now is Jack Lynch. He's the editor of Samuel Johnson's Dictionary, which is a new released book, about which includes many excerpts from the original dictionary published by Samuel Johnson in the 1755. Was it, Jack Lynch?
Yes, it was.
And Jack Lynch is an English professor at Rutgers University. He's also with Simon Winchester at our bureau in New York. Now, it took 70 years and a huge team of contributors and editors to compile the OED. Johnson, though, took less than a decade to put his massive two-volume book together. How did he do it so quickly?
Well, in fact, Johnson boasted that he could do this single-handedly in 3 years. And people balked and laughed, although he did do it in 9, which isn't so bad. When he first suggested he could do it in 3... people pointed out that the French Academy had 40 scholars working full-time for 40 years to do a similar dictionary, and he quipped, "This is the proportion. Let me see. 40 times 40 is 1,600. As 3 to 1,600, so is the proportion of an Englishman to a Frenchman."
Love that man.
Yet it did take him rather longer than he'd anticipated, and he did have to hire some assistants. In his preface, you note that there's a bit of sadness. "I have protracted my work till most of those whom I wish to please have sunk into the grave, and success and miscarriage are empty sounds. I therefore dismiss it with frigid tranquility, having little to fear or hope from censure or from praise."
That's right. He was working very hard throughout this period. His most famous poem was written while he was working on the dictionary. He did a series of 208 essays while working on the dictionary. His play was produced, all the while he was trying to put together a living. It was very difficult for him to write the dictionary, largely because he was short on financial support. In the mid-18th century, it would be unusual for a writer to depend strictly on book sales to support him. He'd typically go to a patron, a wealthy nobleman. He would offer to dedicate his book to the nobleman in return for financial support. So Johnson turned to Lord Chesterfield, one of the most distinguished noblemen of the day, and suggested that the dictionary be dedicated to him. Now, Lord Chesterfield had never heard of this fellow Samuel Johnson and offered him a trivial donation of £10 and then never bothered to talk to him again. So Johnson went it alone and worked for 9 years, putting together a meager living by writing for various miscellaneous publications. And when the dictionary was about to come out, the word on the street was that this was going to be a major achievement. And Chesterfield knew that, and he decided he wanted in on it. So he started writing reviews, anonymous reviews, but everyone knew they were by Chesterfield, in the magazines, talking about this wonderful book that was coming. And he said, "I think the public greatly obliged to Mr. Johnson. I hereby declare that I make a total surrender of all my rights and privileges in the English language to the said Mr. Johnson." And Johnson wasn't amused at all. This was the man who had brushed him off so long ago. And he complained to a friend, "I have sailed a long and painful voyage round the world of the English language, and does he now send out two cockboats to tow me into the harbor?" So he wrote perhaps the nastiest poison pen letter in the English language to Lord Chesterfield, in which he complained of the fact that he'd been abused for so long, and he said, "7 years, my lord, have now passed since I waited in your outward rooms. Is not a patron, my lord, one who looks with unconcern on a man struggling for life in the water, and when he has reached the ground, encumbers him with help?" This caused him to put in one of those notorious eccentric dictionary definitions that Simon mentioned when he defined patron. Let's see if I can find it in a hurry. His definition of patron was one who countenances, supports, or protects, commonly a wretch who supports with insolence and is paid with flattery.
I was expecting that perhaps he would have gone with, Chesterfield as a sofa of perhaps great discomfort.
No such luck.
Well, let's get another listener involved, and Andrew joins us on the line from Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I have a question about the tension in language between a fixed meaning for a word and its popular usage. Obviously, a word has to have a meaning, a specific meaning that people know and can agree on, but at the same time, language is constantly evolving and changing. And I'm wondering if either of the gentlemen on your show can sort of talk about that problem. I'll give you an example. I teach composition a lot, and increasingly it's clear that people are coming to use the word impact as a synonym for effect. And yet the word impact doesn't mean effect, or at least it didn't mean effect 15 years ago. So,
yeah, my favorite of those, Andrew, is enormity, which nowadays just means something that's very, 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 very big.
Right, but which used to mean colossally evil.
Yes, the enormity of the Holocaust. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so whenever I get students using the word, to impact, meaning, when they mean to affect, I always, tell them, well, this isn't really what the word means. But obviously, at some point, the fact that everybody's using it this way means that it's picked up a new definition. So I'm wondering, how do the editors of dictionaries deal with this? And, how do they decide which definitions and usages are common enough to make them valid, or at least valid for inclusion in a dictionary?
Either of you gentlemen, Jack Lynch, why don't you tackle that first?
Well, Samuel Johnson wrestled with that. I don't think he had anything like a formal ground rule or even rule of thumb to determine when something would get in and when it wouldn't. I suspect the OED editors were much more regular about this. But when Johnson began his dictionary back in 1747, he planned to have a very prescriptive dictionary, one that would fix the language, was his phrase. He wanted to write a dictionary by which the pronunciation of our language may be fixed, by which its purity may be preserved, its use ascertained, and its duration lengthened. Which makes it very clear he wanted to spell out how the language should be from this point on. But 8 years later, after actually working on the dictionary, he came to realize that was a dead end. It was impossible. He said other countries may have formed academies to guard the avenues of their languages, to retain fugitives and repulse intruders. But sounds, he says, are too volatile and subtle for legal restraints. To enchain syllables and to lash the wind are equally the undertakings of pride. So from the very beginning of really solid English lexicography, England had discovered, unlike French, unlike Italian, that it's impossible to fix words. Meanings are always changing. And toward the end of his life, Johnson did a major revision of his dictionary and made thousands of changes to reflect words that had changed meaning just during his lifetime.
I think this particular aspect of the discussion could go on for hours, but just because it's so important an aspect of contemporary lexicography. How do you deal with words that are actually being wrongly used? Not, for instance, a word like sophisticated, which has evolved from you sophisticated sugar by adding salt to it, to its current meaning, or current sense anyway, that's most commonly accepted of someone that, you know, has got a little bit of additional knowledge. That seems fine in the evolution of a word. But between enormity and enormousness, when enormity is clearly wrongly used to mean bigness, or disinterest and uninterest, that confusion, I think dictionary editors have a duty to note that it is being used, let's say disinterest, to mean not interested in something when what it actually means is unbiased, but to say it incorrectly used to mean such and such. So to acknowledge that it is being used, but to mention, just to sort of nudge people in a non-prescriptive way, just in a helpful way, to nudge them towards using it correctly. There's also Fowler, Modern English Usage, which I think is a biblical authority which one should turn to from time to time in these occasional matters of confusion. So I'm all for allowing words to evolve, but on those rare occasions when words are being used actually wrongly, to at least make a rearguard attempt to nudge people to use it properly. If they fail, then they fail, and you have to accept a new definition has been born.
Johnson did some colourful...
I need to interrupt to say that sure. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I also need to add that our earlier caller who wondered about the letter count of the dictionary word meaning alleged to mean a lung disease caused by the inhalation of very fine silica dust, but occurring chiefly as an instance of a very long word, 45 letters for black lung disease derived from volcanoes. But anyway, go ahead, Jack. I'm sorry.
Johnson did some very colorful nudging with some of his more opinionated entries. I just suggested he was a convert to descriptive rather than prescriptive lexicography, but that didn't stop him from making some comments. He said of the word ruse, R-U-S-E, a French word neither elegant nor necessary. And well, through, spelt T-H-R-O apostrophe, he said, is contracted by barbarians from through, with T-H-R-O-U-G-H.
Very entertaining, but as Simon pointed out earlier, one of the origins of the Oxford English Dictionary was to have a dictionary without such opinions in it, just the facts, ma'am. Let's get a caller. Cheryl joins us on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hello, gentlemen. I want to tell you I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
And what a perfect segue, because I was calling to tell you about what I did. I've always enjoyed those words that just aren't commonly used. And when I was in ninth grade, I used the word glabrious intentionally wrongly. Glabrious means without hair. And so I wanted to compliment, or at least make him believe I was complimenting, my ninth grade biology teacher. Oh, thank you, sir. You've been so glabrious. And he obviously didn't know the meaning of the word. But, you know, I was making fun of him behind my back because all ninth graders dislike their biology teachers.
Did he catch you?
No. He said, oh, thank you. And, you know, I, you know, smiled to him and then waited to giggle until I turned my back to walk away.
So it's a glabrious day, Kalu Kale. Cheryl, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And quickly, I wanted to get to an email question from Barry Richmond in Berkeley. Was Samuel Johnson the first to use citations in dictionary making, and did he use citations to determine meanings or illustrate meanings upon which he had already decided?
He was not the first ever to use quotations to illustrate words, but he was the first to do it systematically in English. It had been common in Greek and Latin lexicons, and in a very few cases, earlier English lexicographers had included a few quotations. But Johnson was the first to be really systematic about it and to put many thousands of, well, he has about 114,000 quotations in his book. To give you some idea of how much that swelled it, the biggest dictionary before Johnson was Nathan Bailey's, and he defined take in 362 words. Johnson, when you add in 133 senses and 363 quotations, took more than 8,000 words.
And you can see those in Jack Lynch's editing of Samuel Johnson's dictionary, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much, Jack.
Thank you.
And Simon Winchester's a rather longer dictionary of the OED. He writes the history of it in The Meaning of Everything, the true story of the Oxford English Dictionary. Simon, as always, very nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Both of them were with us from our bureau in New York. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.